To begin with, though, I want to come forward in time from David and go back in time from today, about 500 years, to the time of the Reformation. And here's a quote that sent to me by my son-in-law Peter, came to him from his sister, and I just thought this was so appropriate for what we are talking about and dealing with here today. This comes again from the life of Martin Luther, the great reformer, the man who seemingly fearless, and yet very practical, and very much a leader of other men and women, of course. And this comes from a letter that he wrote to another man, and the letter has to do with whether or not a Christian should flee from the plague. And that day it was the Black Plague. And they did not fully understand it or have a cure for it. But very similar circumstances, but yet very much more dire circumstances than our day. This is what Luther wrote. He said, "I shall ask God mercifully to protect us. Then I shall fumigate, help purify the air, administer medicine, and take it." A little bit of antiquated medical application there, but you understand, comes from a long time ago. He continues, "I shall avoid places and persons where my presence is not needed in order not to become contaminated and thus perchance inflict and pollute others and so cause their death as a result of my negligence. If God should wish to take me, He will surely find me, and I have done what He has expected of me, and so I am not responsible for either my own death or the death of others. If my neighbor needs me, however, I shall not avoid place or person, but I will go freely, as stated above." See, this is such a God-fearing faith. He's talking about his own faith, our faith. This is such a God-fearing faith because it is neither brash nor foolhardy and does not tempt God. I thought that's just... That's one we ought to put on our refrigerator, maybe, if nothing else, these days. That's so right on. Well, David, as I've already mentioned, is another such man. Now, David, at this point in his career, as a young man, was about 17, 18 years old. He had not yet written the Psalms and done all those other things attributed to him. He, in a sense, comes out of nowhere to confront the Philistine challenge. On one mountain, Israel, and on the other, the Philistine army, they were standing toe-to-toe, so to speak, although there was a broad valley between. And each and every day, twice a day, Goliath, the giant, would come out and issue a challenge to any champion that there may be in the Israeli army, that they might come out and face him. He said, "Whoever wins, then they will become the master over the other nation." Well, David happens on the scene, 17, 18 years of age, inexperienced in leadership. He had never attended any leadership seminars. He never read a book on how to be a leader. Yet he instinctively and successfully solved the national crisis in the space of a few hours. He inspired others and led them from the depths of a defeated attitude to a real world victory of giant proportions. Well, we all know the story. Let's enjoy it together. Let's revisit it. But I want you to ask this question as we go forward. How did he do what he did? How was it that David handled this crisis? Is there anything here that we can gain from it as we study it, as we face the crisis we're in, as we face any crisis that may befall us in life? And there certainly will be many more, even after this one. When things do go wrong, when the odds are long, and when all looks bad and the answer is not apparent, what is it that we should do? How should we react? How do we handle the crisis? Three steps, three simple little steps. that only David seemed to find what they were or ascertain what they were and take these steps. We have much to learn, as simple as they may be. Let's begin at number one. Step number one in handling a crisis, don't dwell on the obstacles. Let's begin at chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah. And they encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes-Dagmin. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up the battle array against the Philistines. Now Saul was the king of Israel at this time. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them, and a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, when I say don't dwell on the obstacles, you understand, we always have obstacles. There's always problems in life. It just happened to be at this time, Israel's problem stood 6 cubits and a span. Well, how much is that? Well, I'm not going to go through all the calculation here this morning, but it's somewhere between 9 3/4 feet in English measure and 10 3/4 feet. So basically, we could round it off and say somewhere between 10 and 11 feet tall. Now, I asked for 2 volunteers before we started this live stream, and Todd and Brother Travis, Pastor Travis volunteered. So I said, I want you to get on Todd's shoulders, but I want people to see how tall the Goliath is. And I think Travis was ready to do it. I don't know about Todd. I was only joking. But I do want to show you something. This is one of those expanding deals that you reach up with and put a light bulb in that you can't reach. Never really seemed to work very well, by the way. This rod here is about 11 feet, give or take. And I'm about 6 feet, give or take, and that's stretching it. I'm not really 6 feet, but for rounding off purposes, 5'9", 5'10", will work, right? That's a pretty tall guy. Just help us get some concept of how large this man was. This is about, he would have been about 4 feet taller than an NBA center that stands 7 feet. So, very unusually large and impressive individual. And he's coming out every day, twice a day, and issuing this challenge. And he does this for 40 days. 40 days. So they see him over and over and over, and they see how tall he is. And the Bible says that his armor weighed 5,000 shekels, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 125 pounds. That's just the bronze armor that he had on. Verse 4 says, and a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, and he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. That's about 125 pounds of armor. And then it says, in verse 6, and he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. So he was heavily protected by armor. He had a javelin, which is probably in this instance a little bit of a smaller spear. Verse 7 says, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. Now that means it was very sturdy and strong and quite thick. A weaver's beam is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 inches around, cylindrical. And by the way, I tried to reach around a little league-sized baseball bat, aluminum bat last night, and I couldn't reach around it. And it was at least that big, probably a little bigger. And then on the end of that shaft was an iron spearhead, it says, that weighed 600 shekels. Well, 600 shekels is 15 pounds. So you're talking about a long, heavy spear with a very heavy point. I think I got some illustrations here. This comes from the Creation Museum, and this is a replica made to scale of Goliath's spear. Like, you get some idea of the immensity of it. And I think they have it on display there. They also take it around the churches, and that would be great for us to be able to get that sometime. This comes from some of their promotional material. Here's another one that is helpful. That's a family of three or four. Which is it standing there? Family of two. That's how well I can see that in the back. Pretty huge weapon. So he had to be an unbelievable specimen to wield such an instrument. Then he had a sword, we find out later in the chapter, and of course a spear and an armor bearer, and he was just an unbelievable person. Now, verse 8 says, "Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, 'Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said," verse 10 now, "'I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.'" Now look at verse 11. "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." There was one common universal reaction every day, twice a day, for 40 days as this took place. Look down in verse 16. "And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening." For 40 days, twice a day, 80 times, the challenge came. And it produced the same response in every case. Verse 24 says, "And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid." What was happening? Well, every time that Goliath walked out in that valley, I think he looked just a little bit bigger. Every time he strode out there, he looked more immense, more formidable than they could imagine. He was growing in stature in their minds. They were dwelling on something that seemed to be an insurmountable problem. And when you dwell on a problem, especially a problem that at first seems insurmountable, the only possible conclusion is it will evoke fear. That's exactly what was happening here. Goliath had no takers. Fear reigned in the camp of Israel. David, on the other hand, shows up. And David has a totally different perspective. Let's look at verse 12. "And David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons, and the man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of the 3 sons that who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest of the 3. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep." Now remember, in chapter 16, the previous chapter, David was selected to play on his instrument to soothe the depressed and discouraged spirit of Saul. But he didn't stay. When Saul cheered up, he went back and he was sent out to keep his father's sheep. So he returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep, verse 15. He was a shepherd. Now, 17, 18, he was basically a grown man. I don't know how long he'd been doing this. But David was not just a little shepherd boy of 8, 10, 12 years old. No, a little bit more than that. And we come to verse 16, and it says, "And the Philistines drew near." We read that verse. Verse 17, "And Jesse said to his son David, 'Take now for your brothers an ephah of the dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them.' And they supplied their their army this way. Common thing. Verse 20, David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him and came to the camp of the army going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. And as he talked to them, there was the champion of the Philistines of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the army of the Philistines and spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they heard them, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. Except for David. He did not dwell on the obstacle. What did he do? He focused on the opportunity. That was the way he was. Verse 25. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich and give with great riches and give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." Well, that is what David heard, far and away above all the taunts of Goliath. And David spoke to the men who stood by him saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine?" He's like, "Tell me again. I want to hear that again." He wants to dwell on the opportunity, whereas everyone else was dwelling on the obstacle. He says, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" Well, you see, fear looks at what can be lost, while faith looks at what can be gained. That's where David was. Now, how do you suppose he looked at this? I don't think David was without fear. I really don't. Now, I think he had long ago since learned how to handle any fear that emerged in his mind. You know, fear is not a bad thing. God created us with the emotional capacity to be afraid. If not, we would all live short lives, for sure. So, I don't think David was unafraid. I don't think he was fearless, any more than Martin Luther was fearless, though he seems like a fearless character. Now, I do believe that David always handled his fear. He had learned to handle it. And we're going to find out how in just a little bit. But one thing he did was he didn't dwell on the obstacle. He looked at the opportunity. And that's exactly what's here. I mean, what if David would have lost his life? Well, would that have been such a bad thing to stand before God as the only man in the whole nation of Israel that was willing to stand up for God? That speaks pretty good for a person, or pretty well of a person going ahead for all eternity, I think. And if he were to kill the Goliath, kill the giant, look at all that he had. You know, he would be rich, he would be honored, he would have married up for sure, considering the shepherd to the king's daughter. So, number one, don't dwell on the obstacles. Now, the second thing we need to do in order to handle any crisis is to focus on our responsibilities. Focus on our responsibilities. So, let's see how David did that. Let's take up at verse 25. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen the man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills the king will enrich with great riches and give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes." That was the opportunity. David's already processed that. Now look what happens next. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him saying, "What shall be done?" Hey, repeat that to me, okay? We've seen that. But in the context of this, in the rest of verse 26, we read this. He says, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that should defy the armies of the living God?" David not only saw the opportunity, but David saw the responsibility. The responsibility of Saul. The responsibility of every other soldier in the army of Saul. His brother's responsibility. Even his responsibility, although he wasn't even in the army. This man, be a giant, yes, but he was defying the armies of God. He was besmirching the name of God. Here was David's responsibility and every man's responsibility, although none of the rest of them stood up to the responsibility, to stand up for God. Let's go on. Verse 27, and the people answered him in this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. So they reiterated all that would come to him. In the midst of this, his brother Eliab, the oldest, speaks up. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, why did you come down here, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. No, he hadn't. He didn't come down to see the battle. He came down to win the battle. But Eliab had apparently come down to be a spectator and to flee in front of the enemy like everybody else. You see, Eliab is upset because David is showing him up. Little brother is making big brother look bad. By the way, he's making everybody else's big brother look bad. He's making Saul look bad. And David said, what have I done now? Can't you just see the youngest saying this to the oldest? Like, I've heard it before from you. What have I done now? Is there not a cause? Well, what was that cause? To stand up for the honor of God and the glory of God and the name of God and the army of God and the nation of God. That was his responsibility. Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing, and these people answered him as the first ones did. David continued to look at the opportunity and understand the responsibility. He wasn't looking at Goliath at all. Well, he had made his decision back in verse 26 when he first said, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine? He already decided. Nobody else is going to do it. He already saw their cowardice. He said to himself, I'm going to go. I'm going to get in the battle. So he had made his choice. You see, when you consider the opportunities at hand, and you base your choices upon those opportunities and the responsibility that falls on your shoulders in the meantime, then you have no choice but to take a stand. So, don't dwell on the obstacles. Step one in handling a crisis. Number two, focus on the responsibilities. Then number three, proceed on faith. Pretty simple. It's a very simple outline. Very profound message here, though. Proceed on faith. Now, we already read, beginning in verse 28, how Eliab tried to pressure him to give up this foolhardy... Eliab may have even had... a tinge of responsibility toward his father to not let the youngest go out against this giant. We'll give him some credit there. But there was pressure from Eliab for David to act faithlessly like everybody else. And David says, what have I done now, verse 29? Is there not a cause? Now, look at verse 31. Now, when the words which David spoke were heard, they were reported to Saul, and he sent for him. He said, David's done made up his mind. He's ready to go. Saul gets word of it. Saul calls for him, verse 32. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. Hey, don't worry, Saul. Here's a 17-year-old saying to King Saul, hey, don't worry about it. I got it covered. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. Now, David was not a little boy, but he was not very old either. He was a young man, almost of age to be in military service, but maybe not quite. But Saul doesn't say you're not big enough, you're not strong enough, you're not able physically. He just says, you don't have the experience. Now, that's important to understand as we go on. But anyway, he resists the pressure to act faithlessly in regard to Eliab, now confronted with Saul saying, you know, you just don't know how to handle this situation. David now, at this point, reflects on his past, reflects on the faithfulness of God to him in past situations. And that's beginning at verse 34. You see, David already killed two giants. What? Yes. He'd already killed two giants. Let me show you their picture. There they are. An Asiatic lion and a Syrian brown bear. Both of these creatures, full-grown males, go over 500 pounds. Either of them, in any case, outweighs, if David was a strapping 17, 18-year-old, which I think he was, and he weighed 200 pounds, either one of these guys would have outweighed him by 2.5 times. And they're killing machines. Now look at verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, but when a lion and a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by his beard and struck and killed it. Literally killed a lion with his bare hands. He may have had a knife. That's the only thing I can think of. And he grabbed a hold of the mane and probably inserted the knife. I don't know. Your servant has killed both a lion and a bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. He has defied the army of the living God. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. See, David was experienced. God had made sure he had the appropriate experience for this. That's why he could do what he did. He'd already killed two giants. Now we see David's preparation. In spite of his confidence, in spite of his faith, he was not unreasonable. But like we read about Martin Luther, there's certain reasonable, practical, wise things to do in a crisis. So we take up at, verse 38. The previous verse, verse 37, Saul had said, go, and the Lord be with you. Verse 38, so Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put on a bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, but he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot walk with them. So David took them off. You know, a lot of times when you hear this story told, it was they didn't fit. You know, now Saul is smart enough to understand he wouldn't have given a full-grown man's armor to a little 10 or 12-year-old boy. That just wouldn't have worked. David had to have been of such stature to wear Saul's armor. How big was Saul? He was a big guy. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 9. In describing Saul, it says, and he had a choice and handsome son. That is just describing Kish's son, who was Saul. He had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. That means David was looking down on a lot of folks too. David was a strapping young man. By the way, the Hebrew word handsome, quoted twice in that verse, has a very special meaning because we see it again in 1 Samuel chapter 16, 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 12, and it's used to describe David. David is described this way in 1 Samuel 16, 12. He is said to be ruddy. That means he had red hair. A little unusual, not altogether unique. But people with red hair in that day versus the dark hair were considered to be, beautiful in their minds. A mark of beauty. So he was red hair. He was ruddy. And it says he had bright eyes. And with bright eyes, That means his countenance was pleasing. He was a good looking, fine, handsome man. But then he says this, and good looking. Well, wait a minute, didn't he just say that? This word translated good looking from the Hebrew right here is the same word translated handsome twice back in 1 Samuel 9. So in 1 Samuel 9, it wasn't saying that Saul was handsome. That's what the previous word here in verse 12 of chapter 16 says. He was bright-eyed. Yeah, he had a bright countenance. He had a good countenance. But when it says he was good-looking, it's meaning that he had powerful physical presence. He was well-muscled, matured. He was an unusual physical specimen. And that's what David was. Saul never argued about that. Saul only said he was inexperienced. But when he persisted, Saul puts him in his own armor. Then David rejects that armor because he wasn't used to wearing it. It would take some practice to be able to maneuver in that kind of armor. So, when he rejected the armor of Saul, David opted for maneuverability and speed on the battlefield. That's what he had over Goliath, who was huge, muscle-bound, weighted down. David was swift, agile, total striking difference. By the way, David had Goliath outgunned. You say, how's that? We saw Goliath's spear and his sword had to be massive and he had the javelin. Yeah, that's three instruments. That's three weapons. David had five. He picked up five stones. He had the giant outgunned. And he had the giant outmaneuvered. He could outflank him. He was speedy. He was quick. An experience. Let's take up the story again. At verse 40, he took his staff, the long shepherd's staff, and in his hand, and he chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near the Philistine. A sling with five stones. Here's a picture of a sling. And I'll give you it's a long, basically a rope. In the center, there would be a little woven pouch-like area to put the stone. It would be held on the two ends here. Now don't try this at home. Last night I put a weight on this thing to see how fast I could move it. And before I even got started, I hit myself in the face. So don't try this at home without a lot of practice. And I don't know what I'm doing. I'll just give you a rough illustration. But the rock would be placed in there. It would be swung at an extremely fast pace. And then you let go of one end and the rock projects forward. Now with practice, as we know from David's story, that rock could be propelled at high speed in a very accurate way. This is exactly what David used to fell Goliath. That's why he chose. He chose what he was used to using. Think about it. The shepherd in the wilderness never runs out of ammunition because there's rocks everywhere in Israel. The sling is virtually weightless. Man on his feet moving sheep all the time. He doesn't need any weight. It's the perfect weapon, you might say, for the shepherd. Not such a bad weapon on the battlefield either. Well, taking up now at verse 41. And the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth. Not because he was small, he was just young. Ruddy, red, and good looking. specimen of a fella, but, you know, he was still just, you know, someone half his size and very young and inexperienced. Verse 43, so the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistines cursed David by his gods. Why did he say that? He didn't even know David had a sling, but he could see the shepherd's staff. Well, he thought this battle's going to end really quick. It's a stick against my sword, my spear, my armor. This guy isn't even wearing any armor. Well, then David pulled out his sling. But first he says this, and David said to the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give your carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth. And all the earth shall know that there is a God in heaven. Wow. That's got to be some of the most profound scripture written in God's Word coming out of the mouth of a man. Then, we'll drop down to verse 48. So it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Notice he ran, he hurried. He's fast, he's quick, he's maneuverable. There's a lightning quick weapon to use that he is very proficient with. Then David put his hand in his bag. He's already moving and he just reaches down and gets out a rock calmly. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. You know, everybody in the army of Israel ran from Goliath. David ran full speed toward him. I'm reminded of the 9/11 responders who ran into that falling building or the building that would soon fall. And what's generally said, a fireman who run into the fiery building when all others are running out. It's a very reasonable example or comparison here. David did this because he knew God was going to help him. He had such confidence, he announced what God was going to do, and he ran into the battle with all exuberance, exercising faith. One last thing. So David prevailed over the Philistine, verse 50. With a sling and with a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. So the stone caused Goliath to fall. He was out, cold, knocked out, or he could have even been dead. I don't know. David knew, but he certainly was dead once David removed his head. Wow. That's a pretty powerful battlefield maneuver here by David all the way around. But I want you to notice something. Now the men of Israel arose, and Judah arose, and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley, and to the gates of Ekron. That's back in Philistia. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shaaraim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. That's where Goliath came from. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their tents. Now I want you to look at verse 54. Then David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. Now when you read that, you might think that, well, now David's just kind of getting a little prideful here. David's just getting a little full of himself. You take and display the head of Goliath back in Jerusalem. No, no, no. You'd be way off if you think that. You'd be way off. The reason is, Israel didn't have Jerusalem. the Jebusites did. And David was saying, you guys are next. That's what he did when he brought the head to Jerusalem. See, the faith that David demonstrated here, he'd never lost. And I want to take you over to 2 Samuel chapter 21 to show you this at the very end of David's life. 2 Samuel 21 verse 16. Then Ishbi-benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought he could kill David. This, Bible scholars believe, is quite possibly, probably, the son of Goliath. Then David is an old man. And David is willing to take on another giant at the very end of his life. He's never lost his faith. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall not go out anymore with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel. He was too old to prevail against this giant. But he was in battle with him. He was either going to kill Goliath's son or he was going to go down himself. And he may well have went down here if Abishai hadn't intervened. The brother of Joab, the nephew of David. I hope when my time comes and they're pushing me down the street in a wheelchair that I still got a sword in my hand. I hope so. And I hope the same is with you when it comes to serving God and exercising faith. By the way, three more giants are killed here in this same chapter. One was killed by Shammah, the third son, who was in the army of Saul and wouldn't fight Goliath, now kills a giant later on in his life. He learned a lesson, didn't he? David showed him how to be a man of faith. So we just wrap this all up. Here's the conclusion. Face your fears with faith. Face fear with faith. Don't dwell on the obstacles. Look at the opportunity. Consider your responsibility. Move ahead in faith. See, there's not a whole lot I can do against this virus, this coronavirus that we're all in. No, that's true. But you can still maintain your faith in this challenge and in every challenge. Don't give up on God. Don't sit there in front of the TV every day just getting more and more and more frightened. Turn off the TV and take up God's Word and read stories like David and Goliath and be revived and be built up. Take the time to learn, to practice, to endeavor, to strive to be a better husband, a better wife, a better son, a better daughter, a better parent. Draw closer to the Lord. Help your neighbors. Find ways to serve. Face your fear with faith.